Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we'll hear how educators are using technology to reach students now learning at home due to the pandemic. We'll also meet artists unable to host shows, getting creative at being creative. Distilleries are producing products like sanitizers, and we'll hear from one of them. Also, throughout Illinois, volunteers who sew are creating needed items for healthcare workers, like face masks.
In a weird way, I think we've seen this before, but crisis does bring people together. The church rises up in this time, and I think individuals do, and they bring hope to one another.
We'll hear about problems with getting tested for COVID-19, and a woman who has faced plenty of challenges talks about gaining perspective. That and more this hour on Statewide. Listening to Statewide. Thanks for being with us again. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, we'll continue coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic here in Illinois and hear how people are coping. For those who work in restaurants to artists, the stay-in-place order is having an impact. We'll also learn how some volunteers are coming to the aid of healthcare workers on the front lines and how some educators are using technology to reach students. That's all ahead on Statewide. There's a lot of discussion right now about positive cases of COVID-19, but are enough people being tested? In the Springfield area, the county health department is asking residents to call its hotline if they think they've been exposed to COVID-19. But because testing is still limited by lack of supply, calling the line is no guarantee of finding out whether you actually have the disease. Mary Hansen explains.
Abigail House knew something might be wrong more than a week ago when she was taking her and her colleagues' temperatures at work.
It was a thermometer that makes a beeping noise, and it has a good beep and a bad beep, and I took mine and it made the bad beep.
The bad beep meant House's temp was a little elevated. She works as a nurse in a research unit at Southern Illinois University School of Medicine in Springfield. She says she went home right away, and her temperature continued to climb over the weekend.
And on Sunday, I learned that I may have been exposed within the community.
House says she had attended a public event with another person who later tested positive for COVID-19. She's since been in self-quarantine. To try to confirm if she has the disease, she started with the county health department's hotline. After the nurses consulted with the Illinois Department of Public Health, which approves or denies most testing requests in Sangamon County, they eventually told her to go to Memorial's new drive-through respiratory clinic on 6th Street. The idea was to rule out flu or common cold before using up a COVID-19 test.
They were in the over-the-head respirators, so not just a mask. They were wearing something fully over their head. They first gave me a mask. And really quickly, they just did the nasal flu swab, so that's the one that goes way up the back of your nose.
It was uncomfortable, but not terrible. The healthcare worker then gave her instructions about keeping herself in quarantine and said she'd get the results back in a few days. It's been about a week, which House has spent at home, limiting her contact with others and not going out. She hasn't heard the results of her flu test, or if her sample has been screened for COVID-19. House says she's already called once, but she's trying to be patient.
I would like that information, but I know that it might not be priority at this time.
In the days since House gave her sample, testing priorities have changed. When county officials announced the first positive case here, the guidance was that testing would focus on those who had symptoms and who had been traveling abroad or been in contact with someone with the disease. Now, according to the County Department of Public Health, which follows guidelines from the State Health Department, testing is focusing on
patients that's hospitalized with severe acute lower respiratory illness like pneumonia, or if a specimen comes from a cluster in a congregate setting, then that would be a nursing home or a group living facility.
That's Gail O'Neill, director of the Sangamon County Department of Public Health. The health department has authorized about 50 people to be tested in the past month. Five have come back positive, including one person who died last week. Dr. Gurpreet Mander is chief medical officer with St. John's Hospital in Springfield. He says they've been following the same guidelines.
If you're sick and you're well enough to go home, have the symptoms, then they are not recommending that we get tested, and that's because of the limited supplies the state has.
Mander says because of the limited supplies, the number of confirmed cases doesn't give the full picture of how much COVID-19 has spread here.
I think the assumption is that it is prevalent in the community and we have to respond to the needs of those who are sicker.
Mander says the focus now is on preparing for a surge in hospitalized COVID-19 patients, which modeling shows could be any time in the next 2 to 6 weeks. The lack of testing is a nationwide problem, one that Governor J.B. Pritzker and his administration have repeatedly complained about. Pritzker lays the blame at the feet of the federal government for not providing more tests. Still, Memorial and St. John's are testing a handful of patients using private labs. But according to a Memorial spokesperson, those tests can take 5 to 7 days to get results back. Results from IDPH labs take about 3. Mander and O'Neill say they're hopeful more screening will be available in the next few weeks. For now, House says she'll keep staying home with her dog.
So even when it's raining, I bet my neighbors think that I've gone totally mad, but we're just chasing each other in the backyard in circles.
As public health professionals say, staying home is exactly what will keep people safe and slow the spread of this disease. I'm Mary Hansen.
And an update to that story, on Wednesday, the Sangamon County Department of Public Health began reporting the number of tests sent to private labs by local hospitals and clinics. And while some results are known, a couple of hundred tests are still pending. Artists throughout Illinois have been hit particularly hard by the social distancing effects of the coronavirus pandemic. Sam Dunklaw gathered stories of their struggles and their solutions for keeping creativity alive.
Rockford painter Laura Gomel says virus-related shutdowns have dealt her a huge blow. She owns an art gallery, teaches art classes, even enters her own work in shows. That typically keeps her busy 6 days a week, but all of that is on hold now, canceled or postponed because of COVID-19.
That's the biggest thing. It's like I don't have any income at all, zero. And I don't know when I'm going to have some, you know what I mean? Because my job depends on people, on interacting with people. That's what I do for a living.
For now, she's at home, caring for her 9-year-old daughter who has Down syndrome. Gomel says she's keeping busy. She's helping with schoolwork and cleaning her house. But she's usually at her studio, painting acrylic portraits and scenes to sell.
Ideas just never stop coming out of my head. You know, I constantly have something I'm working on. And I'm just flatlining.
It's a familiar scene across Illinois. State and local authorities have put the kibosh on big crowds in an effort to contain the new coronavirus. The social scene, as many of us know it, is all but gone for now, leaving many artists and performers out of a job.
I shudder to think about it because on one hand, I think this is when great art gets made, but this is when great artists suffer.
That's Mary McNamara Bernstein, who directs the Rockford Area Arts Council. She says groups like hers are suffering, too. The council had to cancel a big art gallery festival, which would have given artists thousands of new clients and creators to talk with.
I think artists grow from working with other artists and speaking with them and looking at each other's work in person. And I think those conversations that are not able to happen between artists are really the loss.
Further down the road in central Illinois, music students at the state's largest university are feeling that same loss. Bands and choirs at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign should be rehearsing for the spring concert season. If they were, the university's Illinois Wind Symphony might be starting to sound something like this. But now its conductor, Steve Peterson, is lecturing remotely. He was several states away from campus when we chatted.
Again, I'm actually in the mountains in Colorado, and I've only got one bar here. So while it's not good, that's why we dropped out. So.
The U of I is one of the many schools that canceled in-person classes for the rest of the semester. While that might be okay for some majors, big group events are the lifeblood of music students. Without them, it's just not the same, and senior students don't have the time to wait. But to make up for it, Peterson says he's offering students 9 different remote options for finishing his class, aiming to keep things as normal and as flexible as possible.
There's a lot of stress in our lives right now, and some of these students might be home, you know, babysitting their brother or sister or whatever, and they just can't do what we want when we want. So we're trying to be as sensitive as we can.
That's one of the bright spots in all of this. Amateurs and pros alike are getting creative with, well, getting creative. Take Springfield's Theater in the Park organization. Directors were supposed to be hosting in-person auditions for summertime shows, but instead they've asked actors to submit video auditions like this one. Back in Rockford, musicians are giving online lessons and artists are reminding people they're still creating. Brett Whitaker is among them. He still has several murals he has to finish, but in the meantime, he's reaching out to his social media followers for ideas, for jobs, and for hope.
Artists are good problem solvers by nature. Struggle is good. Everybody needs to feel it every once in a while. Just hopefully it doesn't beat too many of us down.
To keep that from happening, musicians like Springfield's Silas Taki are live streaming bedroom concerts like this one every day. Artists are here all the time, he says, even when they're not. Here's to making life on lockdown a little less boring. I'm Sam Dunklaw.
I am shielded in my armor, hiding in my room, safe within my womb. I touch no one, no one touches me. I am a rock, I am an island, and a rock feels no pain.
You can read more of Sam's story. There's a link at statewideshow.com. Since the call went out for medical supplies, people throughout Illinois have been working to bring healthcare workers the personal protective equipment that's needed to battle COVID-19, and it's happening in places like Springfield, where Sarah Albrocht helped organize sewing circles through an outreach ministry at Cherry Hills Church to create cloth face masks for doctors, nurses, and other staff. She spoke with us about how the effort began and how it's going so far.
My husband's a physician with the Springfield Clinic, actually, and you know, he kept alerting me about this pending COVID-19 crisis that he's been studying on for, you know, since mid-January. And I wanted to be able to help the healthcare workers in our community. And anyway, we collaborated with a local outreach ministry and got the word out, you know, assembled a team of seamstresses that just are amazing. And we started making masks, week and a half ago. And it seems like a month ago. We're looking for a way to do this, though, also to follow some guidelines, you know, that are out there. So eventually we've had Hospital Sisters Mission Outreach become our collection area. And then our local dry cleaners is now taking these masks and they're cleaning them, sanitizing them, so that then they can be delivered to the medical facility, you know, hospitals and clinics.
You mentioned your husband being a doctor at Springfield Clinic. I guess, did he give you sort of a heads up that, this is a problem, we don't have enough of these to go around?
Yes. As we were watching other countries approach and go through this crisis, you start crunching numbers and figure things out, and you start to realize we're going to have some shortages and a bit of a crisis here as well. And so, just using that information and thinking what can we do? It just seemed that we can't go save people's lives, really, but we can use the gifts that we have and, you know, bring people together. You know, we're not first responders and we're not medical people, but we are, you know, as individuals, we can do things like this to support those people that are doing that good work.
You mentioned how you wanted to try to do something. That seems to be what I'm hearing from a lot of people. People want to be involved. They want to help how they can, and they're looking for outlets for that.
Yes. A lot of people are, getting their yard work done or cleaning out closets or all those things. Well, when you're done with that, you know, it's time to look outside. It's time to look at how you can really even help others. And so you work on yourself for a little while, but then let's go out and figure out how we can come alongside our community. And again, while we don't have the ability to heal these people, we can certainly help serve and help protect those who do.
We're in an age of mass production, but something like being able to sew at home can really come in handy in a time like this. How many of these masks can your group produce? Do you have any idea at this point?
So I don't know how many we have produced totally. I would say because we've spread this all over, so we have people sewing in Amarillo in Mexico. We've sent the patterns to India. you know, we're trying to get this far and wide, but probably physical masks that I've actually gotten to where they need to go, maybe 1,000 at this point. And I know that there's more mass production happening that I'm not even totally aware of. A big point that we're really stressing now and really trying to get across to people is that we do need to follow a protocol, and that includes for our community getting it to the hospital sisters mission outreach so that they can be properly sanitized, because we don't want to be part of any unintended consequences. We don't want to be part of that. We want to make sure that when people get their hands on these things, that they are clean and sanitary and able to be used effectively.
Do you have an overall goal? Is there a number you're actually going for at this point, or do you just want to keep doing this until the need is not there?
Right. I think that says it very best. You know, I'm, you know, one person. I'm married to a physician. I see him, you know, coming home burdened, dealing with this crisis, and wanting to do his very best. And so all I want to do is do my very best and encourage others to support him and his colleagues, you know, staff, administration, all of those people as they are working through this crisis and all trying to do the best they can do.
This reminds me a bit of maybe something, I don't know, akin to World War II, when you would have people on the home front doing certain things to try to help the war effort, for example. And in this case, I guess the war is against the COVID-19 disease. Do you have that sense that we're more of a community coming together?
I definitely feel that the community is coming together and understanding and searching out things that are more important than maybe they thought before, you know, 3 weeks ago. And so I definitely feel that. So in a weird way, I think we've seen this before, but crisis does bring people together, and it's a beautiful thing. And I, you know, I think that the church rises up in this time, and I think individuals do, and you know, they bring hope to one another.
Sarah Albrocht is from Springfield, and through a church ministry, she organized volunteers to sew medical masks, which are in high demand. More details about that effort and how to produce a homemade mask, available at our website at statewideshow.com. Stick around, there is more to come on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. Coming up, how facing challenges can put things into perspective. And later, restaurants are having to shift their focus to takeout and delivery. We'll hear about one Illinois establishment. That's ahead on Statewide. In the Quad Cities area, a popular bar in LeClaire, Iowa, is now in the disinfectant business. The Mississippi River Distilling Company is one of many retailers shut down by the coronavirus pandemic, but last week it started making hand sanitizer. Michelle O'Neill reports when the co-owners, Ryan Burchett and his brother Garrett, closed their Cody Road Cocktail House, they began hosting virtual happy hours.
Are we on Facebook now?
It would appear so.
Awesome.
Hi, Facebook.
So people were reaching out to us saying, are you going to make hand sanitizer? And I'm like, no, it's not going to work. And then that afternoon, the FDA came out with guidance in the cooperation with the Alcohol Tax and Trade Bureau and said, okay, if you make this very specific one recipe and you do it this way, you can sell this and avoid this taxation and whatnot and get it out there to people. And so we immediately went into hand sanitizer mode and have been running around like crazy ever since.
With enough River Pilot vodka, River Rose gin, and other spirits in its inventory, 4 Mississippi River Distilling Company workers, including Ryan Burchett, are busy making a liquid sanitizer. It's an FDA recipe of 80% alcohol, glycerin, and peroxide, which will eventually be dispensed in spray bottles.
Some of the industrial need might be more than, you know, like we have Union Pacific Railroad called. They want a ton of it because these guys are in close quarters in their trains. And at the end of each shift, they have to sanitize the whole cab. So they want this stuff to be able to spray everything down with. Okay, that makes total sense to me. You know, that's a use that you might not foresee. But if the trains aren't moving, then what happens? You know, we're having supply chain issues all over the country because of this stuff. So it's been interesting to see where some of this interest has come from.
The distillery in LeClaire is fulfilling orders from healthcare facilities first. Burchett says they're filling 1 gallon jugs by hand as fast as they can. That's about 200 bottles per hour, or 1,500 to 2,000 per day.
So many people have reached out. How can I help? Could I help bottle? Could I help deliver? Could I, you know, do this? Could I donate a bottle to the police department? Could I do, you know, whatever? And the overwhelming response from the community has really been great. We just appreciate so much everyone's support and understanding that this doesn't flip a switch and happen overnight, but we're getting to it pretty quick. And folks have just been so gracious in that regard of working with us and giving us a little time to get our sea legs under us. But I think everybody wants to do something that they can feel good about at this point in the game. And we just really are glad to be able to be a part of a solution in some regard.
Other customers may have to wait to pay $50 for a 1 gallon bottle. A 55-gallon drum is only $1,900. They can just fill out an order form and then be patient.
It gives us a source of revenue during this difficult time, allows us to keep our people employed, and also is providing a huge need in the community. So we just feel like it's a huge win-win for everybody. The other thing that I keep reminding people are calling us, you know, with sob stories of, I need it, I'm so sick, or I need this, that. And it's like, wash your hands. Use soap. There's nothing better for this than soap and water. So, and I understand that's not practical for everybody. You know, some of these healthcare workers that are, you know, dealing with people over and over, and they need to be able to do that. But for the majority of people at home, hand sanitizer probably isn't the best option for them. It's going to dry their hands out if they use it too much. Use soap and water.
And until the Cody Road Cocktail House is able to reopen, the Mississippi River Distilling Company will continue to socialize via virtual happy hours, which will probably include giving Ryan Burchett a hard time about his previous career as a TV meteorologist. I'm Michelle O'Neill.
All right, so the title of this movie is Weatherman, The Tale of Ryan Burchett.
Anchorman.
I think we know.
The deadline to file income taxes in Illinois is being pushed to the summer. Governor J.B. Pritzker this week announcing tax filers now have until July 15th.
Aligning our tax day with the federal government's and giving our millions of taxpayers 3 additional months to file their individual returns.
The move will bring some financial relief to those who owe money and allow extra time for those working long hours in response to COVID-19. Pritzker also says tax refunds will be paid in a timely manner. In this uncertain period, it helps to get a little perspective. Last year, we spoke with the author, Courtney Clark. She's battled cancer 3 times, and on the heels of her second go-round, a brain aneurysm was discovered. Yet Clark has maintained a positive outlook on life. She talked about challenges, whether they be health or otherwise. And today on Statewide, we revisit our conversation. Courtney, you've had a lot of challenges to overcome. I read where you called yourself the luckiest unlucky person in the world. You seem so optimistic. Was that always the case?
Well, to be fair, I have always been a person who's had an easier time seeing the possibilities and the bright side. But at the same time, when you go through challenge after challenge, there is a sense of waiting for the other shoe to drop. And that can make you become pessimistic. For me, it was on the heels of my first 2 cancer diagnoses, then getting the diagnosis of a brain aneurysm, completely unrelated to the cancer. And when you get through, it's this competing feeling of, are you kidding me? Haven't I been through enough? This is so unfair. You know, the question we all ask ourselves, why do these things happen to me? But then realizing, my gosh, if I hadn't had the cancer, I never would have had the scan that led the doctors to find this brain aneurysm. So it's this weird competition between certainly the things that have happened to me, these health challenges in particular, pretty unlucky. But you can also shift your perspective and realize, dang, it turns out to kind of be lucky after all. And in facing that and going through times when I didn't feel lucky, I didn't feel happy, realizing that like most things in life, you can perceive something as, oh, this is horrible, this is the worst. And then you can look at it from another angle and go, well, maybe actually this will turn out to be good.
A person, I would think, is entitled to a little self-pity when you face such challenges as cancer or a brain aneurysm or maybe something else that's going on in a person's life.
Absolutely. I would be lying if I pretended like I didn't have some self-pity. In fact, with the brain aneurysm, my recovery, Sean, was so hard, very painful, grueling, long. It just made me feel so helpless because here I was an adult. I was a newlywed and I couldn't take myself to the bathroom. And you feel so powerless that there were some moments when I just wished that I could give up. And I knew how badly that would hurt my family, my brand new husband. And so I embrace that and I talk about it because I do feel like we sometimes look at people who have overcome big health challenges and we look at them as heroes and, oh my gosh, they're so strong and, oh, how did they get through? And I do think it's okay to talk about the challenges and the self-pity, as you say, because if we don't talk about that, then it looks like everybody else is really strong. And then if it's us going through it, we might think, oh, I must really be a weak person because I want to give up. I'm having a bad day. And then the challenge is to not stay there.
You mentioned friends and family, and I've been in that situation knowing people who have gone through certain health scares and other problems that they're facing. And it's a tough situation to be the person on the outside. You always, of course, want to tell somebody to look on the bright side. But at the same time, that's easy for me to say. And so do you have advice for people who know people who are going through some of these things?
I do. It's actually one of the more common questions that I get asked is, how do I help this other person in my life? How do I help somebody else get perspective? One of the reasons it's such a struggle is that perspective, I mean, just even look at the word, it's so personal. And you can't really give somebody else perspective. And we know that because we all kind of bristle whenever you hear the words like, well, at least it's not blah, blah, blah. You know, that often isn't helpful to people who are grieving or going through something difficult. This realization, well, yeah, I mean, it could be worse, but come on. What I have found is helpful is you can't give someone perspective, but you can give them opportunities to get perspective. So for example, if you're a parent and you have a child or a teenager who, you know, didn't get something that they wanted and they feel like their life is over, can you take them to volunteer? Then it'll be more helpful. I was having a conversation actually with a woman yesterday who was in one of my audiences, and she has a friend who lost a spouse. And what she really wants to tell this person is, but at least you got a chance to say goodbye. You know, at least you knew that this was going to happen and you got to live out his last months with him. I have these other friends and they lost their spouse in an accident and they didn't get to say goodbye. But really, you can't hear that from somebody whose spouse is still healthy and present. So in my opinion, then the best way for somebody like that to get perspective might be to go to a grief support group and have that realization on her own. Wow, this person didn't get to say goodbye to their spouse. What I went through was horrible, and I can also still be thankful that I got this one gift.
I'm talking with Courtney Clark. She is an author and cancer survivor. Courtney, you've talked about perspective. That's what you bring to people through not only writing books, but also going out on a lot of speaking engagements.
Yes, I feel like I have the best job in the world because I get to help people. We all struggle, right? It's not always cancer. It's not always health related. I often go into businesses where they're facing change or people are under a lot of stress. And I not only share my story, but I also share research that I've done on how do we rise up to these challenges? What are the strategies that work best to help us manage the stress, the challenges, the chaos, the changes in our lives, and kind of let go of the expectation of what was going to happen? And then how do we continue to be successful moving forward when the world has shifted?
You talked about volunteering, being more involved when you're going through something like that. I know a lot of people who maybe through medication that they are on don't quite feel up to doing those types of things. Is it so much a standpoint that they have to, you know, get out and every single day get up and go do something? Or is it just, is there another way to approach that?
Absolutely. So, in fact, this was what my first book and what my graduate research was on that became the basis for my book, The Giving Prescription, was about how people who are, you know, healing from something, from a trauma, how they can use service and giving back to heal. And it doesn't always mean getting out of the house and volunteering hands-on. That's not the always the right call for everybody, no matter where you are, you know, in your healing trajectory, because of personality differences, whatever it is. But there are ways that you can, the great thing that service gives you, that volunteerism gives you, is a feeling of what's called self-efficacy, right? That's the belief that you can impact the world, your own world, somebody else's world in some way. And through self-efficacy, we regain personal power and strong ego. And you don't have to leave your home, drive somewhere, and volunteer face-to-face with somebody to get those benefits of connecting with other people. It could just be participating in an online forum and providing help and support to somebody else. It's that simple.
I've often heard that, you know, it's the bad things in life, going through the bad times that help people grow, that help them sometimes come out on the other side of that with a much different outlook. That's what you're trying to get across, right?
It's exactly right. When I started doing this research, there's a concept called post-traumatic growth. You know, we hear of post-traumatic stress, and that is absolutely a real thing that happens to a lot of people, but it's almost equally, if not more common, for people to experience this concept of post-traumatic growth. And I think it's because of exactly what we talked about, the perspective. When you go through something different, you can't help but look at life in a different way. And I know that's true for me. I mean, so much of my life changed, my profession, my relationship, because like so many things we go through in life, anytime we go through any big experience, but especially when it's a traumatic experience, we reevaluate who am I and you know, what am I going for in this world and what's my place in this world? What's my purpose? I don't know that we ever fully answer the question, but it helps us refine our answer to the question about, hey, what am I here to do?
For someone who's received a curveball in life or maybe some bad news that they're trying to deal with, what is the one thing you want to get across to them?
Connect to other people, but be really clear about what you're looking for in terms of support. Sometimes the people closest to you in life may not want you to be sad and suffer, so they may say things like, oh, it's not so bad, it's going to be okay, buck up. And you may need to search outside of your inner circle for someone who's been through something similar. So search high and low, lean on every avenue that you have for support, because when we connect to other people, that allows us to find perspective, to take in the information that we need to solve a complicated problem we may not have been up against before. So lean on other people, but be really aware that not everybody is going to be able to give you the advice that you seek.
Author Courtney Clark from a conversation we had last year. You can find out more about her and how she gained perspective through health challenges. Find a link at statewideshow.com. Glad you're with us on Statewide. Find all of our episodes at statewideshow.com. There is more to come. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, a commentary that gives us something to think about and how one restaurant is expanding the idea of takeout. That's ahead. Up next on Statewide, Illinois schools are closed to contain the coronavirus. The state gives schools the power to decide how to teach students online, but student resources at home vary widely. And as Illinois Newsroom's Lee Gaines reports, educators are using technology where they can to help meet students' needs.
Gladys Marquez says about half of the students she works with don't have internet at home. Marquez teaches at Dwight Eisenhower High School in Blue Island on Chicago's South Side. Almost all of her students are children of color and come from low-income families.
Our community is blessed to have adopted a one-to-one platform where students do have access to iPads, and that's a blessing and a curse.
A curse right now because her students can't afford Wi-Fi at home. Many are recent immigrants and some are refugees.
A lot of my kids would go to like McDonald's or Burger King, Dunkin' Donuts to do their homework, or Starbucks because they had access to Wi-Fi. All of which are closed right now.
Marquez posts daily assignments online in a Google Classroom, but a lot of her students have only a cell phone to access that material.
There are certain apps that function much better on their iPad than they would on their phone. There's just so many variables, you know, when you think about, you know, the student's access. You know, is it their phone? Do they have to borrow their parents' phone? It can be a glaring difference between the haves and the have-nots.
Marquez hopes to create a virtual classroom using video chat, but she isn't sure it will work for her students. In the meantime, she's getting creative. One student left a book back at school, and there's no way to get it.
You know, I was sitting there taking pictures of all of the different pages and trying to upload them to the classroom. And, you know, there's just different things that you're trying to do as an educator just to try to fill that void.
The challenges for students depend on their socioeconomic status and the resources they have at home. Lindsay Jensen teaches English at Dwight Township High School, located in a small town south of Joliet. Most of her students are white. Jensen's district came up with its own e-learning plan. Each day, she posts assignments for her students online.
We are to provide students with approximately 15 to 20 minutes worth of work per day in each of our classes. And whatever that looks like is kind of up to each teacher.
If students can't access the internet, they can make up those assignments when school is back in session. State officials say the work completed from home can't count against a student's grade, but can be used for extra credit. Jensen's students aren't worried about internet access, but they are worried about upcoming exams.
My AP English kids are, rightfully so, really nervous about their upcoming AP exam.
Jensen plans to set up a video classroom so that she can get some face-to-face time with her AP students.
You know, I can't just throw test-prepped materials at those kids and expect them to do well on that. They all need instruction.
Jensen says she's really worried about whether her students will be ready for next year.
They are having very different experiences than what our previous students have experienced, and undoubtedly that's going to affect student readiness.
But right now, for Gladys Marquez, there's a daily worry. Are her students in Blue Island getting enough food?
You know, when you get to know them, you know, at a personal level, when you understand their stories and their trauma, and you know that, you know, they live a reality that most children don't have to worry about.
How educators handle their classes right now depends on the resources their students have at home. And closed schools spotlight the disparities between rich and poor. I'm Lee Gaines, Illinois Newsroom.
Although essential businesses are still allowed to operate, many are struggling in the face of the COVID-19 pandemic. Olivia Mitchell tells us how the virus is affecting a needed industry in every community.
Response to COVID-19 is causing delays and closings for sellers and home buyers. Michael Oldenettoy, managing broker for Remax Professionals, says his company made the decision to cancel open houses.
Because open houses invite groups of individuals in a short period of time. And is that what's in the best interest of our clients, knowing what we now know? There's a lot of things that have been affected with our realtor members and with our agents.
Delays also stem from housing inspectors being unwilling to perform home inspections because of contamination fears. To minimize public health risks, title companies and lenders have put restrictions on the public, asking that only signatories attend closings. I'm Olivia Mitchell.
Governor J.B. Pritzker's sister, former U.S. Commerce Secretary Penny Pritzker, is heading up a fundraising organization, the Illinois COVID-19 Response Fund. It's been created to assist local nonprofit agencies. When announced on Thursday, Penny Pritzker said $23 million had already been raised to be distributed to charities that provide food and shelter and other needs. A steering committee will determine where to deploy the money. Governor J.B. Pritzker mentioned he and his wife, M.K., donated $2 million personally to the fund and another $2 million from his family foundation. A restaurant in Chicago's southwest suburbs is expanding on the notion of takeout food in these times of the coronavirus. Monica Ng with member station WBEZ reports.
When the governor's restrictions on restaurants came down last week, Paul Boundis did not want to stop feeding people. He's the co-owner of the Country House restaurant in southwest suburban Alsip. And so he took to Facebook and asked folks about seniors and vulnerable families who might have trouble getting food. He said he'd bring them all free meals as long as they lived in nearby suburbs. And soon, the phone calls came pouring in.
The second you hang up the phone, it rings. The second you hang up the phone, it rings.
That's Boundis, whose team of volunteers has been delivering food in response to those calls. And one of them came in from Julie Malchiff. She's been worried about her elderly parents. They live in Frankfort, southwest of Chicago, but she lives up in Wisconsin.
You know, I'm like 2.5 hours from them, so there isn't too much I can do for them.
But then she saw the Facebook post from Boundis's Country House restaurant.
And that they were offering free delivery to the elderly within the area.
She called not expecting much, since her parents' house in Frankfort was about 25 miles from the restaurant in Alsip.
I didn't know if they would be able to do it.
In fact, the Country House didn't deliver that far, and the volunteer on the phone was about to give Malchiff the bad news. But then Boundis happened to overhear the conversation.
And they said, oh, Frankfort's not really our delivery, you know, area. And I said, no, because I live there, so I'll take it on my way home.
And sure enough, the doorbell rang at 6 o'clock.
That's Malchiff's dad, Bud Malchiff.
And this gentleman came in, and he brought 2 days' worth of food. And I was just totally shocked. I thanked him so much.
Oh, my father was elated. He couldn't believe that someone would actually do that.
Boundis says he and his volunteers have been overwhelmed by reactions like this that they get for just showing up at the door with food and a smile.
15 volunteer delivery people today, and they're all coming back with the same story. They cry.
People have been so touched by these stories that funding has come rolling in over the last week. And this has allowed Boundis, who also runs lunch programs at nearby schools, to open up two of those kitchens this week to meet demand. He's also been able to hire back 10 of his cooks. With a little help from volunteer delivery people outfitted with masks and gloves, he says he's distributed nearly 3,000 meals so far. The crew works long hours, but Boundis says it's worth it.
The emails, the person-to-person drop-offs, I mean, they're just so emotional.
That emotion goes both ways. Bud Malchiff says he was touched by Boundis's delivery and a promise to check in on him and his wife every few days.
I hope he does. Because it's sure going to help us. I'm 93 and my wife is 90, so we don't get out very much.
Malchiff is a World War II veteran. He went to South Shore High School in the early 40s, kind of before the launch of Facebook. So I asked how much he knew about how his daughter found the meal delivery program.
I guess it was an ad on the computer. We don't have a computer. It's poor old-fashioned.
But then he asked me why I was interested in his story. I told him there'd been a lot of bad news lately, and I wanted to tell people about some good news.
Oh, this is the best news you could imagine. We're just totally thrilled. Yeah, you know, when times are tough, everything comes out, and people are basically darn good.
Monica Ng, WBEZ News.
The COVID-19 pandemic continues to unfold here in Illinois and the U.S., and the average citizen is wondering what happens next, what will life be like in the days and months ahead. Dr. Robert Smith is the Dean of the College of Public Affairs and Administration at the University of Illinois Springfield. He offers up this commentary.
Because I sit alone in my apartment, sheltering in place, I have some time to contemplate what happened and where is the average citizen in all of this. I'm also wondering if I'll be able to purchase bottled water or toilet paper. I listen to my neighbors stressing over their work situation or what to do with their children, now home from school for an indefinite period. But I know somehow we will prevail, learn lessons, maybe develop a cure, and come together as a nation in the aftermath of the coronavirus. What is more concerning to me has been the seeming lack of caring, compassion, and civic responsibility that has spread in this country as much as the virus. It has manifested itself at many levels, in many ways, over the past several months of the crisis. For example, where is our leadership, especially at the federal level, for being ahead of this? In other words, we hire, elect, our leaders to take care of things like this, period. I don't care who I should blame or hear anything about why it's not my fault. Just fix it. Get the tests out there and provide the support the health system needs to cope. In addition, conveying some compassion and understanding along the way wouldn't hurt. Why do we always look for a scapegoat, someone else to blame? I have heard, don't go to Chinese restaurants because they have the coronavirus. Do you mean the American owners who live down the street? Or maybe you pass by someone who looks like a foreign national, and others whisper or just blurt it out that these people should, quote, go home. Or regardless of race, you happen to cough into your arm and people run from you or give you the dirtiest looks, like you are the main problem. Even in the grocery store, I have witnessed crowds pushing, yelling, even scuffling over toilet paper or milk. I understand the need for staples for your family in a crisis, but isn't a 48-pack of toilet paper good enough for a family of four for 2 weeks? I even question our officials and health experts who promote the need for social distancing. Why not call it physical distancing? I think we have enough social distancing as it is. That term implies staying away from one another, especially if they might be different somehow. Yes, keep your physical distance and avoid large crowds, but don't isolate yourself so much that you simply don't care about others. And many citizens talk about the need for being isolationist. We simply can't hide or look the other way when an epidemic starts on the other side of the world and within 3 weeks is on our doorsteps. And finally, there are the naysayers. They maintain the official response is silly. It's an overreaction. It's just a flu. It's been around before. They don't seem to care what health officials or government agencies tell them. Just look at spring break for college students in full swing, despite the warnings. And I guess the last example is what leads me back to my point about what happens next after the epidemic is under control. We are all in this together. Like it or not, rich or poor, Republican or Democrat, young or old, Northerner or Southerner, black or brown or white, down the street or around the world. And maybe, just maybe, that realization may become evident in the aftermath of this coronavirus pandemic. Maybe it will help people recognize that we can't do it alone. Citizens helping citizens is what this nation was founded on. Maybe we've forgotten that. But isn't this concept of citizenship what democratic government is all about, coming together to help others for a greater good? When there's a fire, the fire department will be there. When the roads need to be repaired or the garbage needs to be thrown away, the local government will handle that. When there is a foreign threat, the military will protect us. Or in our old age, Social Security will keep us afloat, and Medicare will provide us some help and health care. Oh, and when there is a pandemic like the coronavirus, the CDC, municipal and county hospitals, State Division of Infectious Diseases, and local public health departments will save us. The point here is that we presume that. For our tax dollars, we expect that. We tend to forget their day-to-day role and impact. But in a crisis, we expect government to help. That's what a fully functional, democratic society, made up of citizens and responsive to citizens, is all about. Let's not wait until the next epidemic or crisis to think about these things. Above all, take care of yourself, your loved ones, and your neighbors.
That's Dr. Robert Smith. He's the Dean of the College of Public Affairs and Administration at the University of Illinois Springfield. That will wrap things up for this episode of Statewide. Thanks for joining us. Be with us again next time. We'll have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Statewideshow.com, that's our website. All of our shows can be found there. We're also on Facebook. Just look for Statewide Show. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.